It's that time of year again, Halloween season. On Blood and Black Rum Podcast, we take this very seriously. So, we're going back to the basics with what we're calling Halloweenies 2. Movies that take place on or around Halloween. Your favorites like Hocus Pocus, Ernest Scared Stupid, Terrifier, and more. Tune in all September and October as we smash jack-o'-lanterns and Oktoberfest in equal fashion.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Blood and Black Rum Podcast. I'm Ryan from ColdSploitation.com, joined with my co-host Martin.
How's it going?
Doing well. Spooky season is upon us. We have like 2 weeks left until Halloween. And of course, we're continuing our Halloweenies 2 series. And I must confess, for this episode, we actually don't have a movie that centers around Halloween, which was the theme of this Halloween series. But we have good reason to do it, because it almost feels like a tradition to do a bad David Gordon Green movie every Halloween.
It's the gift that keeps on giving every Halloween.
It sure is. It's like, you know, to a certain extent, that was the same thing with Saw. It was like, another mediocre Saw movie. Except for Saw 10 kind of broke that this year. But now we've got David Gordon Green, who basically has been cemented in the past, 3 years? And truthfully, though, that's not quite true, because we did really enjoy the first Halloween, 2018. I don't know, has it been tainted for you?
No.
No?
No, it still resonates.
It still works.
It's me, like, with Casablanca. It's like, well, at least we'll always have Halloween 2018.
Yeah, right. And I mean, I agree as well. It's not, for me, it's not tainted. It's not, it's like, I can still enjoy Halloween 2018 and pretend that's the only one. That was the, they did one over and that was it.
What a one and done that was.
Yeah, it was fun. And that's kind of how I do feel about it. And like, we've seen Halloween and Halloween Kills. I've seen it twice now.
I have not revisited Ends or Kills at all.
Yeah, I think I watched Kills again to get prepared for Ends, but I haven't watched Ends again, and I really have no desire to. We did that one last year, and I think we absolutely ripped it. There wasn't very many things that we did like about that movie, even though some people would just say, well, you don't like it because Michael Myers isn't in it that much. It's like, no, I don't like it because it was trash. It was bad. It has nothing to do. I don't care. Like, one of my favorite movies, Halloween or not, is Halloween 3, and it doesn't have Michael Myers in it. But this one, I mean, to be fair, it does have one of the best actors ever in it, in Halloween 3. You know,
Tom Atkins.
Absolutely, and his ass. So, like, it's got that going for it already. That's already, like, and 7 out of 10.
And his mustache.
Yeah. An alcoholic. It's like, oh, I can relate, you know? That's... Hates his kids and wife. Totally understand. But, I didn't not like Halloween Ends because it didn't have Michael Myers in it. We didn't like it because of all of the bad decisions that led up to it. And one of the biggest bad decisions was to make it into a trilogy. Because it was clear, after Halloween Kills came out, they did not have three films planned out.
No.
No. It was, hey, Halloween 2018 did really well. So let's just keep milking this cash cow.
I feel like they didn't even have a sequel planned out after Halloween. They just like did the traditional horror bookend of like leaving it on an open note to be like, well, if it does do well, we can be like, oh, he burned alive and that's it.
Yeah.
But if it does make money, we can always come back to it, you know.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. It did well. People enjoyed it. They're like, let's turn them out. And even at the time, when we did hear the news that they were going to make a second one and continue it on, we were like, I don't know. That sounds like a bad idea. You know, especially trying to rush it and get it done for the next year. That's a bad idea. So I think that kind of leads us to the movie that we're covering today, because it is another David Gordon Green film. It is another Blumhouse film, and it's a quote-unquote trilogy of films as well. one that's already been slated. Like, so with Halloween, it was different. And Halloween came out, people were like, wow, that's great. And then they announced the sequels. This one, they were already like, no, we got three in the bag. You even if you don't want more, you're getting more. So it is again, it was like almost like they were going back to this cash cow of like, yeah, this is, well, not only did they needed to make money, let's say that, because they spent a exorbitant amount of money on the rights to the actual franchise, and so they needed it to make money. And so David Gordon Green, here he is. We're planning out another trilogy for absolutely no reason except for the fact that we can say, well, the first ones were a trilogy. Exorcist 1, 2, and Exorcist 3. You know, that was a trilogy. So we're going to do a trilogy here, too. Harken back to those. Of course, we're talking about The Exorcist Believer, which just released to minimal fanfare. One thing too about this movie
to tepid applause.
Yeah. Two people going yeah, quietly.
Well, what was that?
What? So like I said, they needed to make money on these movies. They absolutely needed to because of the cost of the rights. So you could tell because, you know, I watched Big Brother, right? And fucking there are so many tie-ins on Big Brother to like The Exorcist Believer. It's unbelievable. I mean, I don't believe it's called Believer, but I don't believe it, because in Big Brother, not only did they have one of the contestants who got voted out go back and do like a haunted house thing, and it's like, look at this exorcist, we made a haunted house about The Exorcist Believer, and he had to do that probably right after or while he was still in the house and be like, yeah, that was scary, you're gonna love this movie that I haven't seen. Not only did they do that, but later on, not just a couple weeks ago, they had to do another challenge about The Exorcist Believer, where they had like scenes from it, and they showed an early preview to some of the contestants who won the movie. And in that, all the contestants were probably pulled aside by CBS and fucking Blumhouse, and they said, "You better fucking like this movie, you know, you better watch, you better be enraptured." And you better come out when we interview you, and you better have two, possibly even three, if you can believe it, good moments that you want to talk about from this movie. Because that's basically what they did. They had to say, like, it was so scary. I can't believe how scary it was. You know, and it's just crazy to me. Like, you know that they were worried, like, that shareholders were worried. They were like, this movie. This movie's garbage. This movie sucks. Put it on Big Brother. At least we'll get, you know, the CBS 40 and older crowd to, like, possibly be interested in this movie.
Oh, I remember The Exorcist.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, like...
Do you remember The Exorcist?
Like I imagine your mom and my dad did. Like,
oh, that's interesting. They're making a new one. I remember Patrick Ewing flying around the third one.
And no offense to the 40 and older crowd, but seriously though, like, yeah, I'm sure, you know, because I don't watch these, but I'm sure on the CSI and Yellowstone reruns that they've been playing on CBS, the Exorcist trailer's been getting a lot of airtime on there too.
Now, because also too, this film isn't a reboot, technically.
No, it's a sequel.
It's a re-sequel.
Yeah, prequel.
It's a requel. It's a reboot and a sequel.
It's pretty much like what they did with Halloween. Well, there's two other movies, but, like, we're only going to focus on the first one.
But the Believer tagline is stupid. Should have just called it The Exorcist.
The Exorcist again. The Exorcist times two.
No, because, I mean, they've done Halloween 1,000 times.
Sure, sure.
I mean, just on, like, if you're trying to, like, hook Gen Z into this dog shit. Like, that haven't even, you know, I mean, what once was parodied into oblivion in, like, the first couple of scary movies with, like, The Exorcist and even before that is now The Exorcist, though a very important, not just horror film, but film in general. I think it's even in the Library of Congress. I'm not even sure, but I'm pretty sure it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of out of the zeitgeist now. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of a distant thought.
Like, yeah, it's not like it's kind of the same thing like with Rosemary's Baby when we cover that. Like, it's It was a very popular film. It's well regarded, but now a lot of people are just not like, I'm gonna go check out Rosemary's Baby randomly.
Or get a reference. And yes, the film is in the Library of Congress. So
yeah.
Well, I mean, so something that, like, you know, when we were not even like saying kids, but like teenagers, that was still something that was constantly, like, if you were watching like a Simpsons like Treehouse of Horror episode, there's gonna be like an Exorcist like reference every year.
Mm-hmm.
Has fallen, and I mean, granted, the film is 50 years old now, but still, fallen completely out of the zeitgeist in, like, you know, the modern thought. Like, so if you were to be like, hey, show to a kid, what do you think of this? They'd be like, what the fuck is this? They'd have no connection. So the fact that they're adding a tagline on it, I think it's kind of stupid, just because it's going to alienate, like, to those who are like, Exorcist believer, what's the tagline for? Oh, it's part of a franchise. I haven't seen any of these goddamn movies. I'm not interested.
Yeah, I mean, and to be honest with you, I'm sure we'll talk about it, but the tagline really means nothing in the scope of the film anyway. I mean, to me, the tag... We'll talk about the themes and...
If you're just mad because you didn't hear Smash Mouth, and then I saw her face...
I'm surprised after the downbeat ending they didn't break out with that. You know, instead of Tubular Bells being played at the end, they should have just done Gone with Smash Mouth. You know, maybe they just couldn't secure the rights.
Wouldn't that be great of them, like, all the actors, like, smiling as, like, the credit card, like, shows them, you know, like, you know, like, you're watching, like, Full House.
Right, like a family comedy.
And it's
like,
yeah.
Look at how happy they were.
Bloopers are playing. That one kicked my vagina a little too forcefully that time. Let's do that take again, David.
So we'll talk about the tagline and whether it even means anything in scope of the movie itself. But I agree. I think, like, the idea of bringing this back as a requel and doing a similar idea to what they did with Halloween, which is basically let's pretend like the first film exists and then just do a reset on everything else. It's kind of understandable too, because if you think about it, like, most of the other things in the Exorcist series, Exorcist 2, Heretic, really poorly regarded. Exorcist 3, people like a lot, but it doesn't really have much connection with the original Exorcist. And then you have, like, Exorcist the Beginning, which kind of muddles things even further. You have the Exorcist TV series, which had two seasons of different things happening with, you know, random characters. So it's very muddled. Like, the actual idea of, like, trying to slog through all of the various things that have happened in the franchise and trying to make sense of it all, kind of muddled. So I understand, like, kind of just harkening back to the first one and just being like, all right, let's excise everything else besides that first one. And the same thing was true with Halloween. I understood why they would do that as well. But I also think that, you know, at a certain point, if you're going to do all that, like, is it better to just make itself and not use the franchise and just go and do something new instead of just doing that? I mean, it's not like there's a dearth of exorcism movies either. Like, fucking exorcist movies are coming out every year. There's like three or four major ones that come out every year. You got, like, you know, even stuff like The Conjuring do exorcisms. You know, like, the first Conjuring has a very prevalent exorcism. So it's not like there's a dearth of them. They're out and about. And so you got to be really good. The movie has to be really good to be like, wow, I've not seen that before. That was a great exorcism movie. So all that to say, and I think we've shown our cards here a little bit, but I feel like it's clear we didn't really enjoy the movie. And after we take our break of beer, we'll tell you why.
It's basically, to kind of sum it up, like a lot of these kind of movies we do, it's kind of like just a head scratcher of, like, why?
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason why is to introduce a property back into popular culture to see if it's, you know, still making money. And
right, it's like,
unfortunately, it's not getting the treatment that it should.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing about it too is, like, spending so much money on the rights, where you're like, let's see if it has any appeal.
They gave up the Halloween rights. Didn't you say Fox bought them?
Miramax did.
Miramax.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's just, yeah, it's a puzzling thing. And we'll talk about, you know, all of that as we get into the movie. But let's take a break real quick and talk about the beer that we've got on the show today. I'll let you take it because you're the one that picked it up today.
Okay. Hey, Ryan. Do you like the Midwest?
Yeah. Would I want to live there? No. Do I think about it fondly? Sure.
Do you like flyover country? as those politicians like to say, nobody cares about those in flyover country.
Do I think about it often? No.
Well, you should. Because today we have a beer from the heart of the Midwest, from Wisconsin. And today's beer is from a noted Wisconsin big brewer, which we've done a couple of times. Lionkugel's.
The beer that's fun to say. Lionies.
What are you having? I'm having a liney. I do like Lionkugel's quite a bit.
I think they should have a tagline like, my hiney's having a liney. It's like, what are you going to get at the bar? I don't know why I did that in a Boston accent, but what are you going to get at the bar?
Yeah, what the hell was that? Like, yeah.
My hiney's having a liney.
I'm going down to the Cubs game. I'm going to have myself seven line. Actually, no, if you're going to the Cubs game, you're drinking old style, which is Chicago. But point is, so we're having a Lionkugel's today. You know, a nice, big, but not so big national brewer based in the heart of the Midwest. Kind of like Wisconsin's Genesee.
And fun fact, some of my earliest craft beer tries were Lime
Kugels. Yes.
Yeah.
I don't even know if you can consider them craft beer, but they do.
Yeah.
But they do, you know.
I guess I should say non-domestic style, you know, big lagers. Yeah.
But they do, you know, they're readily available here. They have been forever. And I don't buy Lion Kugels often, but I do like, you know. But, you know, every now and then, if I see, like, a new offer, like last year when they had that Oktoberfest that they did with I can't remember which German brewer it was, but when they did that collab, that was great, and it's like, I gotta have it.
Mm-hmm.
But they do, you know, make pretty, nothing great, but very good different types of German and Austrian style of beers.
Mm-hmm.
And today they have a seasonal now for the fall, now slowly starting to close into winter. And they have a nice red lager. But don't let that fool you, because it's not a red lager. It's a Vienna-style lager. So red lager is basically just because, you know, it's of its multi-characteristic. And as I take a sip, as you will know from our podcast, if you've listened for the past 9 years, we're big fans of Vienna-style lagers here.
Yep.
They're very good. It's an underutilized style.
Mm-hmm.
It's light, bright, crisp, easy to drink, but it does have enough maltiness to the body and enough breadiness to give it a, I would say, Mars and Light style.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about it. A, you know, sipper all year round, though it does, like, kind of, you know, make you feel more the fall and winter. Like, I could drink Vienna lagers all day long, because, like, even still with Sam's kind of, you know, fucking around with their Boston lager, you know, and fucking around with all their stupid shit, the Boston lager is always a great go-to, because it's just a great Vienna-style lager.
Yep.
And Lionkugel's here does a damn good job with it, too. I like it a lot. It's light, crisp, easy to drink, bready, nice and caramely at the beginning, malty, too. That maltiness kind of gives it a heaviness that isn't really there because it's only 4.9%. Very easy to drink. It's delightful. This would pair great with some schnitzel and some pretzels and some, you know, ground-style mustard. I like it a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. Like you said, we really do like Vienna lager styles. I feel like Vienna lagers, when someone announces a new Vienna lager or something like that, it's actually, you know, a really underappreciated beer. It's one of those, you know, like, beer snobs are going to be like, oh, it's not a smoothie, it's not an IPA, a double IPA, or it's not a stout, then I'm not interested. But Vienna lagers are, if you think about it, are actually pretty difficult to get right. It's not like, you know, with an IPA, you can mess up, throw a bunch of hops in and be like, it's bitter on purpose. I don't know. You just don't like hops. I'm conflating that a little bit. But Vienna lagers are a distinct style. And if you don't get it right, you don't get it right. And people are going to know. Like, you taste it and you're like, it's not lager. Like, it's way too hoppy. It's way, you know, you can really easily mess it up. With the Vienna lager style, we really like that. I like the spread lager quite a bit. You know, like you mentioned Boston Lager, that's a good comparison. If this is not the same as Boston Lager, definitely has a few different characteristics than the Boston Lager. That one's a bit more peppery, a bit more spicy with the hop balance. But Leinekugel's does have a very good, distinct malt presence, as you said. Nice bit of caramel, but not to the overall extent of like an Irish red ale. Certainly not in that presence. But it does have a nice little caramel element to it. It does have a nice, muted hop presence, so it's not overpowering, but it is there. And then you do have, like, the nice, very light, easy-drinking Vienna lager style that brings it all together to kind of pair it all, and works really well. It's very drinkable, 4.9%, so it's not super heavy on the alcohol scale, so you can drink a few of them and, you know, still be okay. I think you hit it on the head too. This is a nice lead in to winter, as I had texted you earlier. 10 out of 10 pick, as we kind of get towards the end of the fall season, October, and heading into colder weather. This is a good pick. But at the same time, as a Vienna lager, you can drink it pretty much all year round, and it still would work because it's very drinkable. But the caramelness of it, the maltiness, really does lead you into like the nice winter weather, give a little warming characteristic to it. All around, I think it's a really solid beer. You know, again, it's not like knock out of the park amazing, you got to try this kind of beer, but it's a very solid, consistent beer from Leinekugel's. So I think
Sam's Boston Lager, great introduction.
Yep, and it's also like really inoffensive too. So like if you're not sure that you would like a Vienna lager style, or you're not really a big craft beer fan where you don't want to go for like various different styles, I think this red lager would be a really good introduction to some of the other styles. It's like a little bit different. It's not your normal, you know, Pilsner style lager.
It's a little bit breadier, not too bready. Has a little bit of like a little grassiness to it too, but not like anything like, oh, but you know, it's like a nice little introduction. I think Leinekugel's does a great job at kind of, you know, filling that role of these styles that, you know, you'd be like, oh, I don't know if I'm gonna like them. Like, see, like what you think of men, it's like, wow, I'll try more. I think they do a really good job. And yes, you're right too. When I can't remember, like we were talking about a bunch of like IPA brewers and this off the show, and their attempts at these different like Czech lagers and Japanese rice lagers, and it's like, if you can't make a fucking good lager, don't even bother, because you know the people who love these IPAs and, you know, are overwhelmed and think lowly of the paler, you know, styles. You find like that they're like, oh, they can't make a good lager or, you know, Dunkel or Schwarz beer for shit, because it's like, you don't know what you're doing. There is an artistry to it, you know. It's hard also to make very good, very crisp, very drinkable, light style beers. So,
definitely.
All right. So let's go into Barney's Great Adventure.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about the Exorcist Believer. So the first thing that stood out to me, and well, not the first thing actually, it was technically the last thing that stood out to me, but what I noticed when we're watching the credits, because our theater pretty much practically made us stick through the credits. They're like, we're not fucking turning on the lights until we see those black rolling credits. Because the Exorcist Believer does end with like red credits on a black font or a black background, and it kind of looks like there might be a lead into, you know, an end credit scene, and there's not, by the way. If you're sticking around for that, you've already stayed too long. So But anyway, what I noticed was that, again, this is another movie, and I didn't realize that, but it was written by Danny McBride, David Gordon Green, and Scott Teams. They wrote the actual story itself, and then the screenplay was written by David Gordon Green and Peter Sattler. But I did not realize that Danny McBride had his hand in The Exorcist Believer as well. But it does make sense, especially with Scott Teams being on the actual storyline too, because he was a big part of Halloween Kills, also wrote the screenplay on that one. And so I guess we're kind of, what we're getting at here is that there is a lot of times on these movies, especially like when we're talking about Halloween Kills, Halloween Ends, there's a lot of people getting writing credit. And when you have that many people working on a screenplay, working on a script itself, you got three people working on that script, you have the danger of having too many hands in the bucket. You've got too many people that are working on too many different ideas of what the story should be. And I understand that, you know, a lot of times they have people who are on a writing team, right? You have a writer's, you know, a whole writing squad, right? And that's generally for TV shows. But you have three people working on a script like that. The chances that you're going to go off and tangents, different directions that generally don't make sense or don't seem cohesive are a lot greater. And I feel like when you get that with the three writers on, or at least the three people who contributed story on The Exorcist Believer, it kind of makes sense why this movie feels so piecemeal at times, feels like it skips a lot of the information that would be really useful to actually have. And not only that, but it feels like it is trying to basically carry water until we can get to the actual meat of the trilogy, right? Because we know at this point that it's definitely slated to be a trilogy. We know that the second movie has already been apparently been written, or it's in production. They're working on it. So the thing I'll say about Exorcist Believer is it feels like, especially when you're watching it, it feels like it's treading water. It's just waiting to do something. So I think that that's one of the main problems of this movie is, again, there's too many people that were working on the script and screenplay and story. It's too muddled, and you don't have a clear, consistent picture of where the film should be heading. Not only that, but forcing it to be a trilogy where you don't really have a trilogy, or you don't have a story that's going to be able to hit those, you know, have enough information, have enough steam for three of those movies. It's definitely problematic. So with that said, I mean, I guess we should start by saying that, you know, this movie, to me, doesn't even start until, like, the first hour is over. I don't know if you felt that way as well, but I felt like almost, like, literally 1 hour of this movie is just basic, like, prologue, introduction. Yeah.
It's babble. This film is tiring. As we've said a billion times on the show, the greatest sin a film can make, or any form of media, this film is not bad because it's not well made. It's bad because it's well thought out, well, not paced well at all, and full of just tedium.
Mm.
It's boring. This film is boring as shit. There's no excitement. And the fact, and you're right, that the first hour of this film is police procedural, like you're watching a Law and Order episode without Jerry Orbach and Sam Waterston, makes it beyond ridiculous and beyond tedious.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's
so the whole prelude in Haiti is immaterial. There's like the 20 minutes we spend in the opening of like, oh, I'm in Haiti with my wife and look at poverty is so lovely. Woo! And then there's an earthquake. Woo! Of course, we have to have the trope of your pregnant wife. You have to choose. Who do you save, the wife or the baby? Oh, what do I do?
I think that, you know, that opening scene, like, honestly, I didn't necessarily mind the fact that, like, oh, yeah, it's set during, like, a literal real tragedy that had occurred. And you know, did it seem like it was a little bit you know,
Hammond says.
Yeah, it did, but I also didn't mind that so much. What I really minded was how unrealistic that scene plays out, where it's just like there's no rhyme or reason that the doctors even offer as to like why can you only save one or the other. Like, what is the actual what are you going to be doing? They don't even give you a realistic scenario. It's just like you need to choose. It's like, how does he even know that it's actually correct? They don't tell us.
Cause it's Haiti and they're poor. Yeah. That's why
the film just offers up like this idea. It's like, yep, you gotta choose. Really sorry, it's bad. I know it's a horrible decision, but like for purposes outside of what we can explain here, you're just gonna have to pick one.
Huh?
You know, and it doesn't even offer up like a realistic scenario. So to me, it was almost laughable because it just seems so out of left field of just like, yeah, we're gonna have to make a terrible decision. And, you know, it's obviously setting up everything for the later film. And you know what the decision, that's the other thing. It's not leading to any sort of revelation that you're seeing this and you have to spend 25 minutes in this extended prologue sequence, because you already know. You know, like, if you've seen the trailer, you know, okay, well, the daughter survived. So, all right, moving on. You know, that's what happened.
Is this supposed to be a smart critique on abortion? No. It's just... because, like, you know, you would think that could possibly tie in with today's mind, U.S. politics.
Mm-hmm.
With some of the things that get brought up throughout the film. And at the very end where they reveal, like, you know, that the dad didn't want the kid. He wanted the mom to survive, but the kid survived and the mom died anyway. Like, it's just stupid. It's just like Disney pablum of like, mom's dead. I have to raise you alone now. But I mean, like, the whole setup, it's like, it's okay, but at the same time, like, it's too long and, like, too bombastic and stupid. It's just...
yeah, like, you touched on it. I mean, I understand why we have to have this setup, because it does bring up the whole idea of, hey, the demon knows you, like, your worst terrible secrets of, like, what happened, right? So, like, we need that setup of showing that he actually picked to save his wife. And, you know, even though that didn't happen, that was his decision, and so the demon knows that, right? So I understand that we have to have that, but, like, the whole first hour is just way too long-winded. Even after we get past all of Haiti and we're 13 years later, and now, you know, obviously his daughter Angela has grown up and she's 13, and
poor child is bedeviled with the most giant forehead.
Oh no, I'm sorry, Liddy Jewett, but it is a little bit true. It is true.
I felt so bad when, like, watching the movie. I couldn't help but constantly think, like, oh, she's got such a gigantic.
When you see that hit, like, the window, like, up close to person, like, oh! You know, that's the scary part, not the demon. I'm sorry, we're being mean.
It's like I could watch the film on.
Oh no. No, we're being mean. But anyway, like, you know, you've got Angela being 13 years old. She's being a little teenager. She's understanding, you know, that her mom is dead, and she wants to kind of like harken back to that and maybe even talk to her. And so that's where the whole idea of them holding some sort of like ritual to try to make contact with her dead mother occurs.
I like, too, that dad's also the 1% of people who, like, when their significant other dies, they're like, never know another person's touch again.
Yeah. He's like, he's Mr. Mom in this movie. I mean, and I'm not saying that's a bad thing. You know, it's kind of refreshing actually to see, like, hey, single dad doing the job, right?
Well, I mean, it's just funny because usually, like, when people, like, go through that, it's like, my husband's dead. And then, like, a week later,
I got a boyfriend.
I got a new one. Because I'm afraid of being alone and my insurance is not. I need insurance.
You're right. Yeah. So it is a bit refreshing. You see that. I agree. But like the whole idea, like, I think with the biggest thing about the first hour is that you are both treated to something that feels so extended and over long, especially after, you have like all kinds of scenes of basically Leslie Odom Jr.'s character just kind of like going through the stages of grief in 3 days of like, she's missing. We'll find her. I'm so angry. I'm going to go out looking for her. And it feels like the worst, longest episode of like SVU that you can think of, because it has all of the tropes. You've got angry fucking dad in...
You're waiting for Marissa Haggerty to show up.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
All right, come on, guys. We got this.
You know, because, like, it's not just Angela that goes missing. There's another girl that goes missing along with Catherine. It goes missing along with her. And so you've got her parents as well that are, meeting with the police. And you've got angry fucking dad who's, like, throwing garbage cans around. And you kind of got to sit through all this and just... take it for the next hour of just sitting there watching them, and especially the police, not really get anything done, just kind of going through the motions. And like you said, it is a procedural in a certain sense, but what I will say is probably the worst part of this is that for all the things that it takes on and tries to show in this first hour of like grief and like missing your children and guilt of being a parent that couldn't like provide to them, what it does also do is not tell you anything about a lot of these characters. Like, they're all one-dimensional. One of my favorite things is fucking Ann Dowd's character, who's a nurse, Ann. She has her own name. This movie was so unmemorable, she couldn't remember a different character name, so they had to name her Ann. She's like, what the fuck is that? What am I doing in this movie?
But take your goddamn garbage cans back out. Yeah.
But the funniest thing to me is that just Ann... is just fucking everywhere all the time. It's like, this nurse is 24/7 nurse in the hospital. That's all she... this is her life. And except for worrying about garbage cans.
And the police station, too.
She's everywhere. This lady is just like... and not only that, but she gets involved in a way that doesn't even really make sense. It's just like, I feel bad because his daughter's missing, so I'm going to basically shadow him forever. I'm going to be the nurse constantly. I'm going to, take on the exorcism role. I'm just going to be everything. And it doesn't, like, you don't really meet these people. It's just like, all of a sudden, she's in the background of every shot. And even you commented during the movie, you were like, she's the one. She's the one causing the demons. You know, basically, because it is, they kind of set it up like that. It's just like, why is this lady everywhere? It's like she's stalking them. But then you also get to meet, like, certain other characters, like the people's pastor, right? Raphael Sparge, or however you say his name, Sparge. And, like, he's just there. He just is a guy that is at their church, and then all of a sudden, he's...
how dare you?
Sorry, mega church.
Hold on. No, how dare you? You know who that is?
No. No, I don't.
That is Karth Onassi in Knights of the Old Republic.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The greatest video game of all time. I didn't realize that it was him until you said his name, and then now it's all... it's all coming back to me. How dare you sit here and give Ralph Sabarji, Raphael Sabar, shit over this? How dare you?
I'm not giving him shit per se. I'm giving the film itself shit for basically just throwing these characters in and then just being like, audience, please just accept them as being a part of the cast now. The crew.
Also, too, if you play Mass Effect like a loser, it's he's also Kaden.
So good to know.
So when you get to choose Ashley or Kaden, who to pick in the first game, who to survive, you choose Kaden.
Choose Kaden.
Because he's Karth Onassi.
Good to know. But do you agree, like this movie, even at 1 hour of the movie where you're like, oh my god, can this move any slower? Can this get on with it?
It's fucking, this film drags its feet. After the whole, Haiti prelude that takes 15 minutes. It takes, as you said, like an hour to actually get into what's actually happening. Because the next 20 minutes is family fun time of like, oh, look at me with my daughter. I don't let her have friends because I'm her friend. Friend, you're my friend. Big billboard brow child. And then after all that, they get to do a seance, like this is the Ouija board movie. Like, if we do a seance, maybe you'll be able to speak to, you know, spooky people. Ooh. And then they go disappearing and police procedural happens. And then they get found. And that's wonderful. And then the creepy stuff.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, is like, you're going into an exorcist movie. You're not thinking you're going to sit through a procedural for a whole hour where almost nothing creepy happens. It's like zilch, zero. At one point, I was like, besides the whole Blumhouse intro, I was like, am I even in the right movie? Like, is this like, because I don't even think there is a Exorcist Believer title card, is there? Did you remember that? Because I don't remember.
No, there was no title card.
Yeah, there's no title card. You could think you're in the wrong movie for the... You're just thinking, I'm in a bad movie. I don't know what it is, but it's...
That's right. We should be doing Taylor Swift errors right now.
Yeah. And so, I like... Once it gets to the part where they've actually found the children, they got them back, and some weird stuff starts happening, like when they get Angela home. I felt like the movie could start picking up its pace and start doing some things that I thought could be interesting. And I will say, and one of the reasons why I don't think this movie is necessarily what I would say a bad movie, is that, like you said, it is well produced, well shot, fairly well edited in terms of like just making sure the content's there. It does have a good production value, and I do think that at times David Gordon Green does know how to direct suspense. Like the whole scene where Angela's in the bathroom and her dad's in the bathroom brushing teeth, and it like seems very clear like something weird is going on, and Angela keeps going back and forth. The lights keep turning out and stuff. Was very reminiscent of The Exorcist 3 and how characters keep going in through doors, and then all of a sudden something scary comes out of another door that you're least expecting. I thought that was like going to kind of do that sort of thing. And I was like, oh, this is kind of cool. Like, it's getting a little bit more suspenseful, intense. And all of a sudden, done. That's it. Before anything even spooky happens, that atmosphere just dissipates and it just cuts to a new day, switching off like all of that tension that just started to build. And I feel like that's the biggest thing with The Exorcist Believer that really took me out of the movie, is that all the times it starts to build things, it just immediately switches off, and it's almost like you're getting immediate blue balls from it. You're just like, oh man, this is getting kind of interesting. I think things are going to get a little bit spooky. And then bam, someone says, hey, you know what? I got a headache. No more spooks tonight. You know? Because I did feel like there was room in for that tension and suspense. And it just doesn't go anywhere. It is lost. Like something like The Conjuring, which has, especially the first movie, which has a very, it's sort of slow, but it does have a very nuanced and consistent pacing to it, where it's like, here's some information about the family, here's a little bit of a scare, here's some information about a family, here's a little bit of a scare, and it keeps building on that tension until it sort of compiles. This movie has none of that. It has no sense of pacing whatsoever. It really seems like every time it starts to get too spooky, it's almost like Disney Channel came in and was like, whoa, whoa, this is a movie for 10-year-olds.
For everybody.
That's a little bit on the spooky side. You know? So I always got that feeling. It was like, just when I was starting to really mount, cut away and do something else. And that's disappointing because, again, the first hour of the movie has no scares whatsoever. Nothing spooky, really. The spookiest part is probably the burnt pancakes that the dad tries to pass off for Angela when she comes back home. It's like, I made pancakes. And I was like, dude, that's a little bit burnt. Yeah, that's that. That was my biggest, probably my biggest complaint. Constant lack of tension throughout, and it all feels like it's building to the last half hour. Maybe is a half hour where it's the full exorcism. I think I was checking my watch because I was like, when is this going to be over? But I think it was probably about the last half hour. And it almost feels like all of the movie is just like waiting, waiting and waiting so that they can just show this exorcism scene. And with this exorcism scene, they basically bring in a whole bunch of characters that you're like, who? Who are these people? Like, you mentioned Stuart. Who's Stuart?
Who are you?
Yeah, and you're like, you looked up the synopsis and it was like, Pentecostal priest Stuart. And in the movie, that is far from clear. It just seems like he's the neighbor that wants
They don't mention that. They don't mention that. He's like, he's always a Pentecostal.
No, it's just like, oh yeah. I just thought he's just a neighbor. He wants to help out. Kind of like Anne. Anne's the nurse. She's concerned about the children. So they're helping out. This film does not make it clear who any of these people really are or even why they're important.
Like, it has the idea of trying to tie down, like, there's these different, every religion has these, and cultures have these different versions of exorcism and how to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't go into it. It's just kind of there as fanfare, like, because this time, you know, we get to, yes, there's the Catholic aspect of it, but we get to see, you know, Baptist preacher and, you know, what Catherine and her family, they're Baptists. That's made clear. But, like, the whole, like, I'm Stuart the Pentecostal. There, you know, and he's just, like, he just breaks into their home and is like, I have this woman throwing sea salt on your bathroom to eat.
Yeah. You know, it kind of would be.
Like they don't say, like, by the way, I'm also a Pentecostal.
With the way that some devout religious types will just readily throw out their faith right away, you would probably be more believable to have him just be like, yeah, I'm Pentecostal, just so you know, live across the street, I'm here for you, you know, just to actually literally explicitly say it.
We're good friends, we're good friends.
Yeah, and not only that, but that's the Pentecostal, but they've also got other faiths in here. They've got, like, another woman that they bring in who is an oncologist turned faith healer, something like that.
Yeah.
And basically, they don't really explain.
The voodoo aspect is a totally missed opportunity example.
Yeah.
Haitian, like, voodoo, practice in the beginning. It's kind of like, oh, is that what's going to be the key to this, you know, demon? No. You know, so it's like totally a missed opportunity and, like, you know.
And the film really doesn't do, like, it seems like with the element of the tagline, believer, and the fact that Leslie Odom Jr.'s character is faithless. He doesn't really believe in anything because of his wife dying and stuff like that. It seems like it's going to be a play on, well, Catholicism itself is not just the only thing that could really combat demons, right? Like, a variety of faiths can combat demons. It's not just one particular one that works. But the film then kind of goes into detail of, like, no, Catholicism is really the one that works. You know, like, they try to really play that up when, you know, they get Father Maddox and it's like, he's the only one that could really help. Like, all these other people, like, it's kind of like a fuck you to them, right? Like, because they're...
I do love, too, though, when he's like, I've seen this, and I suggested exorcism, and they're like, no! Like, all the priests are like, no, we're not fucking doing that. And it's fucking stupid.
Yeah. I like...
And they just shoot him down, and he's like, oh, come on.
Yeah. I mean... The way that they put their faith into, like, the Catholicism and the way that he comes in shooting in, and I've seen other people comment about this too, like a fucking, like, he's out of the fucking Avengers in this movie, because they that's not my joke, that's someone else's, but
they cue up the theme to
yeah, and he basically comes in. I mean, it is kind of you know, obviously misled, because eventually he does end up getting, you know, completely murdered with his head twisting around.
How dare you?
What?
How dare you kill that man?
Yeah, right? But, like, so I kind of liked in a way how it did circumvent that, and like, no, that didn't work either. But at the same time, it does feel like the film is like, hey, all these other faiths, like, yeah, they're fine and everything, but like, Catholicism? That's really what's going to work if anything's going to work. And I really wanted it to go a different way. I wanted it to actually look at different religions and be like, okay, well, you know, we don't need to perform the Catholic rites here. We can do something else and it will also work, the faith. What I dislike immensely is the film's ending where this exorcism is occurring and they have a fucking Kamehameha battle with smoke that fucking drips out of the children's mouths, and then there's smoke in the fireplace that comes out, and it has a midair smoke battle that you don't get to see any climactic thing happening. It looks really stupid. It sounds as stupid as it is on screen, and it's a really bad decision to have this like sage battling demon ectoplasm, whatever it is. It's stupid. It's really stupid. And what I also really dislike is the end where they basically have to make a decision whether they're going to save Catherine or they're going to save Angela. So, like, basically the demon. And this film is also not clear. Are they both possessed by the same demon? Are there two different demons? Is it Pazuzu from the first, you know, from The Exorcist? Or is it a different demon? Makes it seem like it is Pazuzu, because we haven't even talked about Ellen Burstyn being here. Chris McNeil coming back from
it's another random Babylonian fucking...
Yeah.
Demon.
Demon that's like...
You wouldn't be able to pick out of unless you're like a theocracy scholar.
Yeah, the film's not clear. It doesn't tell us. But anyway...
How do these Babylonians demons have to fight with, like, Jesus? As you said, too, like, how imagine I feel like being, like, a vampire. And after, you know, this day, all of a sudden, little teas make you sad.
Yeah, I know. Like, it's what it leads up to is basically them making a decision. And I do understand the idea of you basically offering this up to Leslie Odom Jr.'s character, being like, you didn't want her. Do you want her now? Do you want to keep her now? And then the other parents who are clearly going to decide, because you know that the father has been shown he's off, you know, he's off the handle. He can't just, you know, be normal. He's a dad up to an 11. And so they offer this choice. Which one are you going to keep? He obviously keeps the other dad keeps his daughter Catherine, and then the demon takes Catherine and kills her and leaves Angela. And the thing that I think is stupid is that why would a demon even make that choice? Why would they even do that? Because like, they could easily just say, hey, make that choice and then kill Catherine, and then be like, oh yeah, actually we're gonna kill Angela too. It just doesn't realistically jive. Like, a demon would want to cause the most chaos, the most mischief. It wouldn't just be like, I feel bad for you guys. You didn't make a choice. So, you get your daughter back. It turns into like a Saw game at the end. It's a really bizarre decision. It just doesn't mesh with The Exorcist at all, to me, in my opinion. Like, all the tropes are there. Puking up stuff. Neck twisting. All that stuff that you would think of as Exorcist stuff is here. But at the same time, this doesn't really feel like an Exorcist movie to me. And even though it has two times the exorcisms, it actually is just really boring. The exorcism itself is not handled well either. It's just like, things are happening. Like I said, you get a smoke demon thing that comes out, and then it's over. And the whole movie was leading up to that, and you're like, that's it? That was the exorcism that we were waiting for. If you think about The Exorcist, the original, the whole movie is the exorcism. It takes that long. These priests are like, I don't know what the fuck to do. This demon is very strong. What do we do? You know? And it takes the whole movie and ideas about faith and parents' guilt and things like that. And it does that so much stronger than this movie can ever hope to achieve, in my opinion.
I think also, too, the film's kind of ruined. Excuse me. the film is kind of also ruined by the effects.
Mm-hmm.
I think what also hinders this film is, not that the effects are bad, but the effects are CGI, and they're not nearly as effective or impactful as, you know, obviously the original, which is one of the goats of, like, you know, practical effects. That's something that's also pulled me out during the movie, especially during the whole exorcism part of the film, is that the effects were CGI. Nothing terrible or, you know, offensive, but the fact that, you know, they're CGI, you enter Uncanny Valley with what's going on, and the effectiveness of what's going on to these two girls is totally mitigated.
I agree. I think that, like, I don't think that the makeup effects are too poor on the girls, especially Catherine. Catherine looks a lot like Reagan. I mean, they've done a lot of makeup effects on her to make her look exactly like Reagan when she's possessed. So I don't think the makeup itself is that bad. It's everything else that happens that is just not that that interesting. The other thing I wanted to point out too is that they take Angela out of a mental health facility, and just like, they're just like, yeah, we're gonna take her home. She's been like smashing her head, crawling under floors, crawling on like the walls like a spider, and they're like, yeah, okay, we'll let you take her home. You know, it's like the same facility that has Michael in the Halloween movies. I'm just like, I don't know. Somehow he got out. I don't know.
You're good to go.
Yeah. Yeah. It's laughably poor. What do you think? Because, like I said, we didn't talk about this. What do you think about Ellen Burstyn coming back as Chris McNeil? You know, basically reprising her role from the first movie as the mom.
Well, she is the only actor with a pulse in this film. But fucking weird. The fact that she lives in this giant seaside manor all of a sudden, like, from selling a couple of books, and she looks like Helen Mirren, and she's just like, yes, the exorcism made me billions of dollars, but I miss my daughter Regan. It's just for the, it's literally only there to tie you back into, like, oh yeah, this isn't just a remake, it's the sequel to The Exorcist.
Yeah, I mean,
it's so shallow and pedantic.
It's really funny because there's scenes during The Exorcism where they'll flash to Chris McNeil, who's not even there, by the way. She's gotten her eyes clawed out. Poor lady. They bring her back for this movie. They throw her into a room and say, hey, like, try to exorcise this girl. And she does, and, like, is not successful at all, gets her eyes clawed out. So now she's in a hospital while they're doing the exorcism. And they keep cutting away to her in the hospital, not being able to see anything. And it's like, why do you keep showing her to us? Like, she's not even involved. She's there trying to listen to a podcast episode, you know? She's not fucking part of this exorcism. So it's just funny sometimes. They keep cutting away like she's spiritually connected or something. It does. I think you're right. It's just like, hey, what if we just brought her back for this movie for some reason? You know, it's almost like in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake, where they brought what's her name back? From the original. And she didn't really get a chance to do anything. It was just kind of like, and again, that was a play taken out of Halloween 2018, where Jamie Lee Curtis is, like, you know, basically the commando of that movie. They brought Marilyn Burns back. They didn't even bring Marilyn Burns back. It was a different lady that played Sally. They brought Sally back as the hardened veteran to basically, like, do nothing in that movie, just to tie in to the original. And that's the same thing that it feels like with Believer. They brought her back for no reason, only to have at the end Reagan come back, Linda Blair, who makes an appearance real quick and is just like, yeah, Mom, I came for you. I saw you had your fucking eyes clawed out. So the least I could do is come back to see you.
I heard you got your eyes gouged out and I wanted to be there for that.
Yeah. And the thing I think is hilarious is on IMDb, Linda Blair is fucking first listed on top cast. So if you have not seen this movie and you go to IMDb, you're like, oh, wow, Linda Blair's in this movie. And then the film has that big surprise at the end before it ends where it's like, oh, Reagan came back. So IMDb is just giving it right away. It's just like, here you go. Fucking Linda Blair is in this movie. You don't even need to watch it. We'll tell you the big twist at the end. Here you go. Yeah, it feels like it's such a cash cow to just say, look at the Easter eggs that we got for The Exorcist. Here's the tie-in. So in terms of the actual exorcisms and things like that, what do you think about the actual haunts, the spooks, the scares in this movie? Is it even scary?
No.
There's nothing scary about this movie. A lot of like the whole, when we get to see like the soul aspects of like the souls being trapped and kind of like they're being dragged underwater. Those are like kind of probably the best, mm-hmm. but they're very Evil Dead that we saw this year.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. Sometimes
Rise,
thank you. But that's like a very stereotypical horror trope. It's also been, you know, done better in a billion other films. Other than that, you know, I don't really think too much of the scares in this movie. Nothing's really scary, especially because the first half is so concentrated on being police procedural, and the whole exorcism bit takes forever to get there. So by the last quarter of the film is the exorcism. There's nothing really that's supposed to be creepy. Like the whole, and also too, the reliance on CGI is also what hampers it. The priest having his neck, you know, snapped by being, you know, contorted in this weird way is ruined by the CGI. It's not bad, but it's just not effective because it's CGI. It doesn't have that, you know, visceralness. So as soon as that guy's neck starts twisting, you can tell, like, yep, that's somebody animated that.
Yeah, and I mean, like, I keep seeing, like, people talking about, like, how is this the scariest movie? And it's like, literally, it doesn't even seem like it's trying to be scary. Like, it doesn't seem like it has any
interest.
Yeah.
It's not interested in being scary. I think you're right. I don't think this film is interested in being a horror film. I think it's more interested in just being this weird supernatural thing, and
I'll
come back later and we'll have something different for you.
Right. And like talking a little bit about its philosophy, a little bit about religion, about believing, about faith. And I don't think it does any of that very well, to be honest with you. I don't think that it comes to any conclusions really about being a believer or non-believer, which the title would suggest. I don't think that it has, besides the fact that it actually literally gives you its own philosophy, but with Anne's character, who unasked basically posits a whole philosophy to a police officer at the end of the movie, basically giving, and she starts out with like, do you know what evil is? And I'm thinking, oh fuck no, evil dies tonight again. Here we go. But like, she basically posits the whole idea of like what evil is, and it's not like a demon, it's just like the unknown or something like shit like that. I don't even remember because I tuned out listening to it because it was a driveling monologue. I don't think that it has a theme basically about where it comes from in the religious element, because I think it's too muddled to even have a theme like that. It just is like, here's an exorcism, we use different faiths, but Catholicism is the main one, and it kind of worked. And that's it. That's the end of the movie. And I guess the only other thing that it's really dealing with is parent guilt. And of course, that was a big part of the original Exorcist. Parent guilt, what you can and can't protect them from. And the same is true of this one, except in this case, it's more like I chose not to have this kid and I have her anyway. And so I spent 13 years giving her a really good life, but this demon is like, all of a sudden, you didn't want her. And now I'm second guessing it. It's kind of stupid, because if you think about it, like as a normal human being, you'd be like, no, I mean, I have shown that I really want this kid. Like I've taken care of her. I didn't throw her in a trash can. Here she is, you know, a nice, healthy 13-year-old. So it's kind of stupid all around. I just don't think it comes to any main conclusion. And it feels like this movie is like part one. You definitely can tell, like, we mean to have something else happen after this. This is like, if you can get through this one, like you said, we might have something better in number two that like will be more interesting for you. But I think for a lot of audiences, they're not going to give any more leeway for a number two. They're not going to go see a number two. You know, it's just not worth it because this film didn't make it worth it to actually be interested in where this series is going. Like, I literally do not care. I don't care what they're going to do with the next one. I'm not enthused or excited about Reagan, Linda Blair being back for the second one. I don't care.
I don't think she's going to be. I think it's just kind of like, shows up and you're like,
yeah, I mean, it's kind of a weird thing too, because when you think about like the Halloween series, of course you're going to be interested in Laurie Strode. She's like the main character, and it's been a big thing and a big part of the franchise to have Michael Target Laurie. But in The Exorcist, you just have Reagan for the first two movies, and I don't think she has a big enough interesting story to really like sell this idea that like, yeah, we're gonna focus on Reagan for the next ones. It's like, no one really cares. She had her exorcisms, and at that point, that's where it ends. Like, I don't really need to see where she's at now 50 years later. I don't know, it's my opinion, I guess. But I guess we should give The Exorcist Believer a rating. If I've covered everything that you wanted to talk about, did I get everything that you you
think that? I think so.
Oh, yes. And so on a scale of 0 to 10, extremely pronounced yawns, because that's what Martin was doing throughout the entire movie. He's like 7 times in the movie yawning, very loud, like luridly loud.
You're welcome.
What would you give The Exorcist Believer?
I give it 5.5. It's just a tedious film. It's not outright bad at anything, but it's incredibly dull. It's incredibly boring. It's drag. It's 2 hours of your life you're not going to get back just because it's such a tepid, uninteresting film. It's bland as shit. The acting, we didn't really talk about it that much, but the acting in this film is terrible. Even though David Gordon Green does do a pretty good job directing it and, you know, shaping the story of this film to what he wants, the acting in this film overall is terrible. There's not a noteworthy performance at all. Everyone is incredible, like they're doing like dinner theater.
And I feel like that's partially just the uninterest in the movie itself. It's just like, what are you going to enthuse into the movie? Like, it's just, I don't know. The whole interest wasn't there.
Like, everyone's uninspired.
Mm-hmm.
It plays very, their character's very downbeat. And, like, anytime anyone's giving a speech, it's, like, the most, like, dinner theater Shakespeare after 3 rounds. Giving, like, the Ostel, like, Hamilton, like, I mean, Macbeth speech ever. It's terrible. Everyone is fucking terrible in this film, acting-wise. It's a well-put-together film. It's not bad on the merits of what it is as a film. It's bad because it's such goddamn bore. And there's nothing interesting that happens. The exorcism part is very boring. Nothing exciting really happens. Nothing's really engaging. There's no real great philosophy here. There's some interesting ideas on, like, different, like, practices on exorcism, but the fact that they revert to just bland old Christianity, tiresome. The fact that the story's just this giant mess, the first hour of this 2-hour film is a
elongated, terrible episode of Law and Order doesn't help. Like, this film isn't, like, bad because it's a bad film. It's bad because it's nothing. And the fact that we're going to get two more out of these is very scary. Because there's... They have David Gordon Green and those at Blumhouse that are putting this shit together. They have nothing interesting to add to this franchise. And there are few sacred cows that have been unleft and unmarked by the remake bug. And the fact that now this franchise is being touched by it is kind of sad. Just because, like, if you're going to do it, have something interesting, have something unique, but has something that all ties together that makes people engaged and want to be engaged in the franchise. You have to do that. This film fails at that miserably. There's nothing here. And the fact that this film even got greenlit is a fucking testament.
Yeah, I mean, I would give this, you're a little bit more lenient than I was. I would give this a 5. And the reason I'm giving it a 5 is because, like you said, I don't think it's necessary. It's not a poorly made movie. It is a, in all purposes, it is a big budget looking movie, and everything about it, you know, is done quality wise. But it's just a really boring movie that doesn't do anything interesting. And even the movies that have had exorcisms before it that were obviously less prestiged than this movie, for Blumhouse, did things that were more interesting from an exorcism standpoint than this movie. It doesn't really do anything noteworthy. And so that's the big problem with it. It's boring for about an hour. It doesn't do anything in that time frame. And then it gets to the exorcism itself, and it doesn't do anything new. And even so, like, it's got two exorcisms. It's got two people that are demonic. And you're like, how can this go wrong? How can you not have anything interesting occur? You have two people that have demons in them. It's mind-boggling, to be honest with you, that it could have such a budget, such names behind it, and be so uninteresting. And I think that shows in pretty much every aspect of this movie, from the acting, because I don't think the actors are really technically to blame. I just think that there was uninteresting script to be working with. It's just directionless and clear that they didn't really have a defined theme for it. I feel like all of the beats that are supposed to really hit and be interesting, they just don't. They don't hit. And I think probably the most suspense happened during our theater viewing, when a guy got up to go get more popcorn or something, and it was really dark, and he stumbled over his chair and fell over and was like going, "Oh, ah, jeez, oh, ouch," and stumbled to the door. And like, "Jeez, I hope that guy's okay." That was like the most suspenseful thing. Like, did he seriously hurt himself? Other than that, you could easily pull yourself away from the movie and be like, "Man, hope that guy's okay." So I think that's the biggest issue. Like, you know, from all purposes of saying this is a movie that is well made, sure, Exorcist Believer is fairly well made. Is it an interesting movie? Is it entertaining? No, not really. And does it set you up to knowing that there's going to be additional sequels? Does it set you up wanting to go see them? Absolutely not. Like, I was already not that excited about seeing any Exorcist movies, but now I'm seriously unexcited, very unexcited, like dreading next year when the new one comes out. So
because it's now in our,
yeah, now oh, yeah, now we have to do it. And I think, like, this was a huge failure from that standpoint of, like, the bar was already low. People were like, you're doing a sequel, a requel for The Exorcist, like, the bar's low. You were like, that's not going to be good. But the bar couldn't be lower than what they've achieved. I mean, it's just really bad. And I don't know. Like, is it watchable? Sure. You're not going to enjoy it, though. And I think that's a big sin. All right, so it's our episode on Exorcist Believer. What do you want to do next week?
Wrap up Halloweenies?
Yeah, I think so. Pretty much, right? We got...
it's our last one to wrap.
I think that's it. I don't know. We'll go back to a Halloween movie, I would think. One last Halloween movie. One last hurrah. There's a couple ones that I was thinking about we could do. There's The Guest, which is a Halloween movie. We did a little different Halloween movie. It's not technically a horror movie. There's the another haunted house style movie, like an actual haunt instead of the houses that October built. It's called Hell House LLC. That we could do. We could do a really one that I think is not that great of a movie. Satan's Little Helper.
I was gonna say that a house of a thousand corpses.
It's not a Halloween movie though.
Neither is this.
We broke the rules.
What about the monsters?
Oh my God! You're gonna make me sit through that one again. You gonna make me watch that again? I don't know. I mean, yes, technically a Halloween style type movie. I think there is actually Halloween in it. If I'm not mistaken, I don't know. I can't remember. Kind of blocked it from my brain. But yeah, that would be a hate watch for sure. I don't know. We'll talk about it. Let's talk about it off the podcast. We'll figure out one last hurrah for our Halloween season. Figure out what we can do. All right. So thanks for listening to our Halloween, non-Halloween episode on The Exorcist Believer. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you didn't actually have to go watch it. Maybe this will be a way for you to experience it vicariously so you don't have to go to the theater and watch it. If you want to hear us cover more, and we're coming to the end of the Halloween season, but we're going to have a whole bunch of stuff coming up. I think we're going to do Mean Girls at some point here in the near future. We're going to obviously have another Thanksgiving-style episode. Maybe we'll go see the new Thanksgiving Eli Roth movie. You'll want to subscribe to us on any podcast app that you can think of. We're on Apple Podcasts, home base at anchor.fm, which is now Spotify, pretty much anything else. Subscribe and leave us a nice review. We're on Facebook and Twitter. Search for us on there. We have an email address at bloodbackrunpodcast@gmail.com. You can write to us. Let us know what you like, what you don't like, what movies you want us to watch, and we'll consider it. And you can donate to us on our Patreon page or on our Spotify page. Whatever you donate, we'll put back towards beer, so we appreciate that. And thanks in advance. Other than that, that's our episode on The Exorcist Believer. Hope to see you back next time for our final Halloween episode. And until then.